Broadcasting from the confines of an abandoned radio station in the secluded ghost town of High Strangeness, just outside of Area 51. It's time for full.
I don't hear her.
Topics they told us were off limits. Hello, everybody. I'm Connie Willis, and this is Coast to Coast AM, broadcasting live from the KOA News Radio Studios of iHeartMedia in Denver, home of, well, where you can drink over 200 different beers brewed daily. You can smoke, vape, chew, and eat marijuana legally. However, there's no kissing rule at Denver's Union Station. It slows down the train. You know, there's something really strange about that. But anyway, time now to turn off the lights and join me for another interesting evening of conversation, much needed education, and the chance that we might get a little closer to the truth of what lurks against us, amongst us, and what is beyond. I'm Connie Willis, and this is Coast to Coast AM. You're listening to Coast AM. Hi, everybody. Connie Willis here. Looking forward to tonight. Should be a really good time. Open lines later after our guest. If you don't know who I am, well, I do have a YouTube channel you can check out. I'd love for you to do that. It's called Blue Rock Talk with Connie Willis, Earth's Most Interesting Conversations. That includes people, places, and things. I have all sorts of fun things on there, so I hope that you subscribe. I do something called Crypto
Coast
Connie
to Coast
Tuesday,
AM is streaming live on KOANewsRadio.com and on the free iHeartRadio app.
Crypto Connie Tuesday, which is all about cryptocurrencies. We put that into layman's terms. It's like the BitShares Dynasty with Stan Larimer. Also, we do something called Swellness Wednesdays. It's alternative health. Wasted Wednesdays, a serious look at the cannabis industry. Far Out Thursdays, and that's, you know, anything far out, remote viewing, aliens. Bigfoot Friday, of course, that speaks for itself and Stan's Bible lecture. So that I hope that you guys would still please go ahead and subscribe to my YouTube channel, Blue Rock Talk with Connie Willis. Now, speaking of the Bigfoot Friday, I do have something called Bigfoot in the Rockies. It's kind of like a documentary. I went out with Sasquatch Journey, a team of Sasquatchers in the Rockies. They took me out for them with them for the day, and I recorded, and they recorded, and I put it together, and I've got it up on my YouTube channel. It's also featured on coasttocoastam.com, so you can check that out, too. I'd like for you to let me know what you think of it. I call it Bigfoot in the Rockies. A lot of fun. We saw more things in 7 hours in one day than most people see in decades of looking. So, I tell you what, I think you're going to like it. Some people love it. Other people, no, why'd you put that music in there? No, because it's my video and I had a good time with it. So I hope that you guys enjoy it too. All right. So we have a really special guest tonight. I'm really looking forward to this. I've been waiting for almost, I don't know, over a year to talk with him. Jim Penniston, you guys know him with the Rendlesham incident. So let me give you a little bit of background on Jim. He was with the United States Air Force Security Forces, retired. He entered the Air Force in 1973, served over 20 years active duty in the U.S. Air Force. And I think it's important to give all his credentials because of the story that you're going to hear tonight. So Jim was assigned to the Strategic Air Command Elite Guard. That's in Omaha, Nebraska, providing security for general officers, congressmen, foreign heads of states, and the president and members of the cabinet. That's a big deal. He held key assignments throughout the world, including service in Desert Shield and Desert Storm. He wrote defense, security, counterterrorism, and contingency plans for the USAF, United States Air Force, and, of course, NATO. Additionally, he provided security support for Air Force One and other classified aircraft weapon systems. He was held for the majority of his 20-year career, a U.S. top secret BISCI and a NATO top secret cosmic autonomous security clearance. I'm going to ask you more about that, Jim, here in a second. But he's the only person I know who has an account like he's going to tell us tonight. And so it's a very special account. So let's go ahead and bring in Jim Penniston. Hey there, Jim. How are you tonight?
Good morning, Connie. I'm doing great.
I guess you are on the other side of the States right now. So it is morning to you.
Yes, it is. And it's cold morning. It's like 20 below here.
And you got the espresso going, right?
I got a double espresso. I'm all ready for you.
Now, this is interesting because, okay, so Jim's got a a book coming out soon. And he's been working on it for a long, long time. He gave me three chapters for myself. It was not even a finished version of it yet. But I got to tell you this, Jim. The three chapters that you gave me exhausted me. It exhausted me. You had wanted to know what I thought. It exhausted me. And it exhausted me because you took me there. I was with you.
Thank you. That's what Gary, my co-author, and I wanted to have happen. I wanted you right there beside me that night.
I was. And I got to tell you, you have, I don't know if it's proper to say this, so maybe I won't, but let me just say you're one brave man to do the things that you did. I don't know how you did it. I don't know how you kept yourself together to be able to do the things that you're going to tell us. I want people to go ahead and I want you to tell the story and let it unfold. But what you did during that time of the account you're about to tell us, I don't know how you did it. I don't know how you did it. You followed the protocol. You did what you were supposed to do. But I think most other people might have been, like you had said, Burroughs was behind you standing there, kind of stuck. So let's get into this. You tell the story as it happened. And I think other people are going to be enthralled in this as well. Now, let me ask something before we get into the story. I've read about the story, I've seen documentaries on the story of Rendlesham and Bent Waters, and I think you might be here now to say, well, here's the real story, because you haven't been totally getting it correct. Am I right or wrong on that?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I would say that everything you thought you knew about Rendlesham is probably not right.
And how long have you been working on this book?
4 years. It's coming
wow.
in 4 years. That's just the tip of it. We had a Rendlesham Forest research team that I commissioned, and they worked on it since 2010, late 2010. And anyway, the leader of that Rendlesham Forest research team, Gary Osborne, he became my co-writer.
Well, I tell you what, the detail, and I guess that has been your main concern with this book, is the detail and to get everything as correct as possible.
Yeah, so we put out a previous book back in, I think, about 2013-14, and it was more of an introduction book to Rendlesham for the United States. And in that book, I had at least 80 pages that didn't go in that book. And my co-author had about 50 at the time that didn't go in. And so immediately when the other book came out, we started pretty much writing the new book. We wanted a definitive book, one that would present the facts, and then we'd go ahead and put the evidence on the notes. Sometimes they're one level, two level, three level, four level, five levels deep on the evidence. And then what we want the public to do is, these are the facts, and make up your mind after you read the book.
Well, like I said, I was exhausted reading that third chapter. I mean, one and two, you know, they got me there, but three... And that's all he gave me, everybody. He just gave me three chapters to look at. But, oh, my goodness, I was right there with you. I was cheering you on and also holding on to you as you were talking about, you know, as I was reading it. I was absolutely there. And the thing was, too, I had these questions. And, of course, I know I'm going to get to talk to you. So I thought, oh, I gotta ask him this. I got to ask him this as I was reading it. And then as I turned the page, you ended up answering it for me.
Good.
Yeah. So I thought, well, I don't have anything to say with him tonight. I'll just bring him on and let him go. So why don't we do that? Let's go ahead and do this. Let's tell me what happened I guess we can start Christmas 1980.
Well, yeah, I'll give you a quick overlay of it.
A quick overlay? What are you thinking?
Well, I tell you what, I could talk about this all night.
I know it. That's what we got, baby.
No, well, let's start. Where is Rendlesham Forest at? Well, I was assigned to twin bases. They were naval bases, U.S. Air Force bases, and they were about 60 miles northeast of London, England. And it was RAF Bentwaters and RAF Woodbridge. And they were separated geographically about 3 miles. And the main operating base, that's where the command centers were, the base commander, wing commander, all that, was RAF Bentwaters. And Woodbridge only had the air recovery squadron, which was helicopters. And then they had two squadrons of A-10s. Anytime during this, when I use an acronym, please stop me. I'm trying to be cognizant of it, but sometimes it's I end up using acronyms, and I might leave someone who wasn't in the Air Force probably not knowing what I'm talking about.
Right. I'll do that. Most of them, I think we know them, but some of them we don't. So absolutely, you got that. Okay.
Okay, and it was over the Christmas schedule. Security, let you know, security police, they're divided into two separate Air Force specialties. Security, which deals with A, Priority B, Priority C resources, which is the war-making capability of the base. And then you have law enforcement, which was usually like gate guards, and they did more police activity on the base. And I worked security, and I was in charge of security for Woodbridge on the, and we were working 12-hour shifts. I think law enforcement was working 8 for the Christmas schedule, and it was on our last midnight shift, and I had went to guard mount, which is where we get all our pass-ons and stuff like that, and we had arrived over at Woodbridge Base early, and we did our posting. I relieved the off-going, and then I started my checklist, what I had to do, like mundane stuff, like like do a perimeter lighting check and stuff like that. And
pretty much any other day, pretty much just everything out of the norm, nothing special except Christmas.
Right, it was quiet. Maintenance wasn't working. They were off, so there wasn't a lot of activity on the base. And I got with the security response team leader, Sergeant McCulley, and he had just finished doing the chow relief for the guys. And I said I'd meet him at Chow Hall at Woodbridge, and we'd do breakfast and that together. And when I arrived at Chow Hall, I didn't really hear the radio in there, and Sergeant McCulley says, "Hey, Jeremy," says, "CSC, Central Security Control, our control center on Bentwaters, is trying to get a hold of you. They want you to phone the office." And we had direct lines from the chow hall to the control center. So I picked it up, and it was Sergeant Coffey. He was a senior controller at the time. And I said, "What's up? What's up, Dave?" And he says, "You need to go to the East Gate." He says, "ASAP." He said, "Run code 2. I said, "What's going on?" Code 2 is with lights. And he said, "Well, the patrolman will brief when you get there," which was odd, too, because that's usually not the way we did it. I said, "Okay." So I responded, just a couple-minute response. It was like, 12:05, something like that, at night. When I arrived there, I met Sergeant Steffens, who was the senior law enforcement guy that was there. And I said, "What's going on, bud?" And he says, he just pointed over toward the Rendlesham Forest area. And I looked over there, and I could see, a dome of light over the canopy of the woods. And then I seen lights within the woods. And Rendlesham Forest is really a thick thick with trees. I mean, they're only like 4 or 5 feet apart. They're not really, too sparse. I mean, they're pretty close together. So I wasn't sure what I was looking at because I've been to, I don't know how many aircraft crashes up to that point, but that was the only conclusion that I could even possibly come up with because of, I did ask Sergeant Steffens, I said, did you see a crash? Did you hear a crash? And he goes, it didn't crash, it landed. I'm saying, no, that does not work for me in my thought process. Nothing can land inside there. A chopper can't, or, our aircraft definitely couldn't. So I asked him, probably to the point of annoying him, at least 3-4 times. I said, it crashed, right? And he goes, no. So I went over to the East Gate. We had a direct line to law enforcement desk, and I picked it up and got the law enforcement desk. So it was patched me in the CSC.
When he kept saying that, Jim, did you think, well, he's tired, maybe that's why he's saying this? I mean, you obviously thought what he was saying was not correct.
Well, I believe Sergeant Steffens, but it didn't
compute.
Yeah, it wasn't possible. It was confusing.
Mm-hmm.
And, anyway, when I got to the control center, the way this works is that when I call the control center, I have the senior controller, I have the, comm plotter on there, I have the, shift commander, I have the flight chief for Bentwaters on there. So that's all instant. And, I said, it appears to be some type of fire. I said, I'm assuming that it could be a downed aircraft. And when I said that, we had one of the security controllers they're checking with London radar, Eastern radar, and of course, Bentwaters radar. And I'm talking to the flight sergeant. And at that time, we had what we call the Status of Forces Agreement with the British. So the only way you could ever go off base is if you had, for a deployment, would be if you had an emergency situation existing, like an aircraft crash. And in the middle of it, Sergeant Dillard got back on the phone, and he says that they were in contact with those three triangulated radar facilities. And they said that they lost contact with a bogey, an unidentified aircraft of some sort, about 15 minutes ago. And so there, along with the observations I was making, that constituted the emergency situation of a possible downing of an aircraft. With that in mind, Lieutenant Buran, the shift commander, he got a hold of the wing command post, and they got a hold of the base commander, Colonel Conrad, and they got permission for us to deploy off base. I took myself and a security airman and a law enforcement airman. And, of course, in my vehicle, we already have a crash kit that, has the plotting boards and stuff like that for the maps. It has a place where stuff I need for the entry control point for the first responders to be set up, where the fire department and the mortuary and anybody else would need to go ahead and go through that one point. So it was my job to go out there, set up the entry control point, render assistance if it was a aircraft crash, but that's usually not it's not hopeful that you'd find anybody alive, usually, in one of those crashes. At least from my past experience, it's usually fatal. But there's also you're supposed to flag like classified if you see it or stuff like that. So we deployed, and we were driving in a Jeep, and the British actually use that force. They would use it like a crop. They would go ahead and they would cut the trees down like every 8, 9, 10 years and use the wood. and then they replant it.
And we're gonna learn a little bit more about that when we come back. We're talking with Jim Penniston of the Rendlesham incident that you guys all know about. I've never known anyone to get as close and do the things he's done. Stay with us. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Connie Willis here, talking with Jim Penniston of the Rendlesham incident. A lot of you call it that, but he's got a book coming up soon called The Rendlesham Enigma. And I got three chapters of it, and it just took me there. As I, it's the only way I can describe it, Jim, is that it exhausted me. I'm still feeling it from reading it. That's how effective this was. So thank you very much for all the work you've been putting into that.
Well, that's awful nice of you to say, but we wanted the public to know. that's exactly what we wanted. We wanted
you did it.
We didn't want to have any embellishments. We didn't want to have any type of information we didn't back up by evidence. And the public deserves it.
And you know what, Jim? You don't have to embellish stories like this. Why? They're already as far out as you can possibly imagine.
Well, there's plenty of people that do that.
This is true.
I tell you what, the event is sensational by itself. You don't have to.
That's right. I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. And so let's get back to the story you were talking about.
All right. Here I was. I mean, I had my team out there. They had earthen like mounds of where the trees had been cut or felled, and I drove as far as I could, and we had to dismount the Jeep because I thought I was going to tip it over. And that was fine because that means that's a likely point for the entry control point. And one of the other problems we were having at that point is our radio communications was, it was starting to break out, which was odd because we had repeater stations all over the Twin Bases there. It never happened to me before. And Sergeant Chandler, the flight chief from Bentwaters, was en route to the East Gate. And so I figured I'll leave Aaron Cabanza, the security guy. I would leave him there, and he could relay radio transmissions. I also broke open the crash kit, got my camera out, then I proceeded with the law enforcement airmen. To the tree line. We were about maybe another 100 feet from the tree line.
And at this point, you still think it's probably a fire, correct? Or a crash?
Right? Yes. Okay. The colors weren't right for burning titanium and stuff like that, but that's what I was going with. As we got to the tree line, it became apparent that it wasn't an aircraft crash. It was mainly a white light inside the woods, maybe 15 feet. It was inside there, maybe 20 feet. And it was at that time, even though I could not hear my control center, I transmitted on my radio. I terminated the downed aircraft protocol. And I implemented a helping hand situation, which is a possible security situation that could affect the war-making capability of that base. And so that was when I knew it was an aircraft crash. I thought it was a security situation.
Did you later find out that they did hear you, or did they never hear you?
Yeah, I found out later on they heard the radio transmissions.
Okay.
Sergeant Coffey heard it. They heard me, implement the helping hand. And there's some other patrols on Bentwaters and on Woodbridge that heard the same thing. So I just couldn't hear them.
I got you.
At that point in time.
Well, it's good that you continued to report then. That was a good thing.
Yeah, I had to do my security checks anyway. They were done at intervals, which I'll keep I don't know, I'll just say they're at done at intervals. And by the way, from the time I got notified at the chow hall to where I'm at right now was probably only 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so everything's moving pretty fast. And as I entered the tree line, I started this white light was so bright you could hardly, you know, squint, you know, with my eyes. And there was, you know, I'm taking all the pictures I can. I'm taking as many pictures as I can of it. And then there's a huge bright white light that I don't know, on a reaction, I just hit the ground. I don't, but there was no explosion. That's what I thought it was.
It came and it shot at you, you mean? It kind of went right to you?
No, it just it encompassed the whole area. And then it started to dissipate, this light again. And as it got up over the first berm, this white light started dissipating to the point. I could see then a shape of a triangular craft there, and which was, well, I wasn't expecting that. And
I guess not. No. What the? So this light, though, was it kind of, it wasn't, was it like you had said it was a dome? It kind of stayed within itself.
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing was, even during this whole episode out there with the, you know, the investigation, I had flashlight on me, but I never used it. And the forest is so thick out there. I mean, it's black.
Right.
I mean, you can hardly see at all. And but that night, there was enough light coming from this object that we didn't need it, and or at least I didn't. And so as the light started to dissipate, this real white bright light, that's when this triangular craft formed, and. Inside the fabric of the skin of the craft, there was gobbler-type color running through it, which is something that, you know, I've never seen before.
You said it was kind of similar, even kind of the lava lamps, kind of similar to that.
Yeah, you know, I still haven't got the right, I still can't explain it exactly I've seen it, but that's close. And then those globular lights, those of color, started to slow down, and then they just disappeared. And all I had was a black triangular craft in front of me with light coming out from underneath it. And then the light underneath it was is non-colored light. It was white. And So I was starting to feel more physical effects as I got closer to it. My movements felt labored, like I was walking through a pool of water, you know, that type of labor,
mm-hmm.
you know, walking. And
yeah.
My clothes, my skin, the hair had like static electricity. And this, I'll call the area right around the craft the sphere of influence, and that's when I started feeling all this. The other thing that I experienced with it was normally there's like air, and you can hear tree branches moving and stuff like that. It was void of sound. I mean, the air was like dead, and you couldn't hear anything. And
you also. You had also mentioned something about time. It was almost as though time had just stopped.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't hear nothing, or there's no sound. I couldn't hear the farm animals that I heard prior to going up to the area. So anyway, I'm going to call it the sphere of influence because that's where the craft was, and say within extended out maybe 10 feet. And that area was all lit up yet. And you know, all around me, looking outside of that area, it all seemed like it was only the area was contained where I was at. And I looked back to the back right with the other airman, and that's about 20 feet away. And he was just like standing there motionless. So I thought he might have been casualty at that point, or just scared to death. I don't know. And then, but anyway, refocused on what was in front of me. And to that point, you know, I started, you know, taking notes because I expended all my film, which was a problem. I wish I would have saved it. I don't know if it would have turned out or not. But then I started taking notes, and I was an emotional wreck at the time.
Your writing did not totally reflect that, though. That's one of the things I wanted to say was you were actually taking notes, writing down what you saw, and it wasn't really reflective. At one point, it got pretty shaky, but I was just surprised that it wasn't shaky, you know, throughout the entire episode. I thought you handled yourself pretty well.
Yeah, my emotions varied. Well, I started getting a little more confidence when you know, I was still all right. Every time a longer period of time went by and I was still all right, I felt a little bit better. So I started, you know, recording, you know, what I could, because I didn't know if I was going to be a casualty or not. And I figured, you know, I might as well record as much as I can for the command element, you know. If you're not going to make it, you might as well, you know, do your job.
You did. I salute you totally. I can't believe it. I mean, superhero there, right there. You saw something that should not exist, or were told does not exist, and you were touching it, looking up underneath it, and writing down what you saw and taking pictures. Most people that see anything like that, they freak out.
Well, I was investigating.
And, yeah, you did great.
I was looking for all the things aircraft have.
It's amazing. Amazing.
I was looking for flaps. I was looking for intakes. I was looking for exhaust. I was looking for a crew compartment. I was looking for all those things, and it was void of them.
Yeah.
And every aircraft that I know then and now has to have those things. It might not have to have a crew compartment. We have drones, but
drones,
they,
right.
They have to have flaps. They have to have the intakes, and they got to have exhaust. I mean, they got to have those things. Anyway, as I got up to it, I seen the light coming off underneath, and so I looked underneath it, and I'm looking for landing gear, and I didn't see any, just this white light. And so I tried to move it, thinking it was suspended, but it was solid. It wouldn't move. And so I didn't have anything to measure it. So, you know, I paced it off. I mean, my stride is about 3 feet. So there was about 9 feet in length. I'm 6'2", 6'2". So it looked like it was between 6 and 7 feet high because of the uneven ground. I couldn't really tell. And so I went around, and I was going to do a 360 and try to identify any markings or if, you know, anything that would help identify the craft. And as I walked around, I seen up on the far end of it, I seen there was some type of writing on it. And I'll be honest, I was a little bit relieved then because I figured it would have, you know, like maybe a U.S. Air Force on it, NASA, a sickle or anything. It could be anything. I was looking for that. And as I got up close to it, there were just pictorial glyphs that were on there, which is really strange because the craft was actually smooth, like black glass. That's what it felt like and looked like. Except for these glyphs, which when you rub your hands over it, it felt like going from the smooth to the maybe like sandpaper, like it was etched in there. And those measured about 5 inches high. I'm using my hand for measurement. And they stretched for about 3 feet. And then above it was a triangular one that seemed to be more prominent. So I continued my walk around, and I didn't find anything significant as far as being able to identify it.
And at this time, all the lights are off of it except what's underneath it at this time.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
Wow. Was it almost like just allowing you to walk around it? You think it was just, I mean, it had, you think it was cognitive that you were there?
Well, I've always had impressions from, you know, I was getting impressions of what I was feeling. And it's the impressions I got that it was intelligence. I mean, it obviously landed. So that took some type of intelligent control.
Must have been beautiful looking out, obviously, when you say like a black glass. Was it just kind of just amazing as well? Spectacular?
Yes, yes. It was, it was quite a technical accomplishment by somebody. I mean, I tell you what, up to that time, you know, we were always, we were briefed on all those silhouettes of aircraft, you know, through the James Book of Aircraft and Warsaw Pact aircraft and our aircraft. In my prior assignment, when I was at Offutt, you know, they had prototypes that were stretched out 20, 30 years for prototype aircraft, and there was nothing that looked like this. So I decided to do another 360 around it, walk around, and I was fascinated with the glyphs. So I started rubbing my hand across them, and when I touched, you know, the triangular one, there was a flash of light so bright I couldn't see, I don't know how long my hand was on there, but I seemed to gain my senses, and I just lifted my hand back off, and the light went away. But it wasn't light. Even though it appeared to be light, it couldn't have been light because my night vision was there. I still had it. And usually if you have a bright light like that, it's going to take 45 minutes or something for your night vision to, you know, readjust. And I had it. So it was some kind of technology that I just could not understand. And when I touched it, though, with this bright light, and I usually gloss over this part of it. I did it even when I spoke recently out of Boulder because it bothers me. There's a lot of trauma with it. But one of the things during that exchange with the light, I was seeing ones and zeros. And to me, it was just like, that was like insanity. I didn't know what was going on.
Ones and zeros. We're going to ask him more about that when we come back. We are talking with Jim Penniston about the Rendlesham incident and what he dealt with. Holy moly. I'm telling you, he's a hero for sure. Brave man. More to come here on Coast to Coast AM.